RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time now for our political panel on Friday here at RCR. We do it every Friday morning at around this time. Always look forward to the political panel. It's a lot of fun. We have great conversations. We hear great analysis, great thinking. And on the panel with me this morning is William McGimsey. Hi, William.
G'day, Paul and panel. Nice to be here.
Yeah, great to have you, William. Maybe you can explain your background, what you bring to the table, and your involvement with RCR now, kind of some behind the scenes, but more up front as well with the new program Spin Cycle.
So I'm William McGimsey. I'm an ex-policy wonk. I've spent most of my career working in government, writing papers for ministers to decide on things. And I've also spent a bit of time working outside of government for various lobby groups and stuff like that, writing papers complaining about the things ministers decide on. But and now I'm sort of, I got sick of that. So now I'm sort of working, we're still doing a bit of advocacy work for various groups. And I've sort of started doing some stuff for RCR as well, including contributing to a number of shows. The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer, I'm a regular feature on there on the weekly roundup. And also I've started helping put together a new show called the Spin Cycle as well, along with the helping out with a few other things behind the scenes as well.
Spin Cycle sounds great, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Marty Gibson. Hi, Marty.
Good morning, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Made it to the end of another week, Marty. You know how it is.
Don't burn out. Don't burn out, Paul.
No, I'm going to burn out.
You've got to, you're setting a cracking pace, like a Nigerian marathon runner. Just kind of like you're just taking off and you just think, oh, how are they going to keep that up? And your legs just keep going.
I'm off to the NZD SOS Christchurch conference this weekend, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Are you going to Auckland?
No. Airfares are too expensive. Yeah, can't get any 79 one-ways at the moment, Marty. Not out of Queenstown anyway. It's all the skiers, the hog in the seats.
Yeah, and no, I'm going to reshuffle and go to the Auckland one. The last year's one was fantastic. I'm really looking forward to it.
And Marie Buskey. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm better now that I'm with you, Paul.
Oh. You can come on anytime. Nice to have you. I'm feeling better because you're all here, actually. So much to talk about, and I always sort of struggle to make a decision on what to start with. What is the most pressing story right now that we should be talking about? Who wants to vote that?
Oh, wow.
Big, long pause.
Well, the thing I was thinking about as I was gassing up my car before I came home to be on here is they're all interrelated. It's a big tangled web. So virtually every story is related to another one, and the challenge is always to stop seeing them as a whole series of discrete things that are happening and understand that they're all kind of connected.
Dots.
Yeah.
Do we all feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, that's very holistic, isn't it? Everything's connected to everything else, and you have to be one with the universe in order to figure out what's really going on. Yeah. No, I think stories are connected. Things happen and they cause other things to happen, and people are observing what's going on and they respond. And so the news is connected in that way.
And also to these, the same old stories and the same old attacks are just appearing under a different guise. So things that you think that you've won a battle in one respect, only for it to pop up somewhere else in another respect. And I think you have to see that, you know, identify that when you see it. And for me, one of those things is the gang patch banning and this legislation. And now that you're here, William, I'd love to get your take on this as somebody who's written policy. They can't seem to make their mind up on this bill. They're adding stuff, tweaking it, and essentially putting really bad rancid salad dressing on a really, really awful limp salad. It's the whole thing is just hogwash, really. And I can't quite get my head around what they're hoping to achieve with this.
Well, I think basically there's a there's a good policy rationale behind it, which is to crack down on the crime that gangs are causing and the misery they're causing. So I think everyone understands and agrees with that. But there's a confounding factor, and that's that gang members are human beings as well, and human beings have human rights. And with the gang patch bill, it's interesting when you read through that the proposed gangs legislation, which I did while I was working for the Free Speech Union, and actually every item in that gang patch legislation took away the rights of gang members in some way, including the gang patch bill, the gang insignia. So displaying your gang insignia is really part of the right of freedom of expression that we normally grant to people. And you can say, well, they're gang members and, you know, they're committing crimes, they're taking other people's rights away, so we should take their rights away too. But that's not how human rights work, or not how lawyers or human rights scholars think they work. Human rights are supposed to apply to everyone, regardless of how they behave. And when you think about what a gang insignia is, when you think about a civil rights organizations, for example, I'm going to say something very controversial here that people may not like, and that's that the line between what a civil rights organization and a lobby group and a gang isn't as clear cut as what you think. So civil rights organizations, if you take Black Power, for example, their logo is a black fist, and then there's various variations on that theme. That's very similar to the logos that a lot of other civil rights organizations have. If you think about the Black Panthers in the United States, is that a civil rights organization or is that a gang? People say, well, gangs commit crimes. Well, civil rights organizations often are involved in civil disobedience as a way of advancing their cause and fighting for their rights. So what I want to convey to people is the line between what a gang is and what a civil rights organization is can be very fuzzy. And we want to be very careful about passing laws that take away the rights of gang members. I mean, I'm a tough on crime guy, but don't go after people's rights, because sometimes what you're perceiving as criminal gang behavior might actually be civil rights type behavior when considered in another way. Really, is Black Power, what Black Power are grouping together to protect one another in the same way that many civil rights organizations do. And I'm not here to defend Black Power, but I'm just saying, well, the only thing that really doing differently is they're cruder and they're more criminal and they're more violent than many other
civil. What if they scare people, though? What if that gang patch actually scares and intimidates people?
Well, you could argue that.
Do you think any people were scared or intimidated by any of the protests that the Black American civil rights movements did in the US? I think that some people would have been intimidated by those protests and movements. Certainly a lot of the things that Malcolm X did, some of those marches. So it's not as easy to draw these distinctions as what people think it is what I'm trying to say.
I'm very much on, so I agree with you 100% on this, and I've been saying this right from when it was announced as a policy platform by the National Party, because I'm very much on the slippery slope. And the minute you set that precedent that you can take those rights away for any group, what then constitutes the definition of a gang? Because they, as you said, there's a very fine line between a civil rights group and a criminal organisation, proven criminal organisation that is a gang. And my concern is that once those powers are there, who's not to stop those of us, for example, who were protesting 2 or 3 years ago, from then saying, well, you can't wear that Voices for Freedom t-shirt, or you can't wear a MAGA hat if you support President Trump, or you can't wear the colours of a political party because that may be triggering to somebody and then constitute a gang. And we've seen how lines have been blurred. And I really think that this is milking mice. Why on earth are they going after something like this when they could actually be focusing on the pathways for criminality, whether that be through digital pathways, whether it be using forensic analysis, all of those sorts of things. Taking away these gang patches just seems to me to be such a knee-jerk, trivial reaction that will only satisfy the pearl clutches of Remy Wera. I find it very frustrating.
It's a matador manoeuvre, isn't it? They're sort of waving the cape and your average New Zealander's charging at it. Yeah, gangs, go crack down on them. It's a bit of a crowbar, in the same way as the anti-smacking bill was a crowbar. No one wants to see kids beaten, but you could tell that it wasn't designed to help kids be safer, well, partly the fact that our stats didn't particularly improve, but there also weren't a lot of ads on TV that followed it telling people how to control oppositional children without smacking them. It's something that allowed the government to get into families, just as firearms license laws allow police to search people's homes without a warrant, just like, you know, cannabis laws. And a policeman said that in that Herald article. It's going to be a good way for us to just get into, good excuse for us to get into gang HQs. But, I mean, the nature of gangs is that they do a lot of scumbag activity that's pretty easy to track down. So if they just enforce the laws they've got, you'd think all they need is a bit of ticker, really.
Here's an interesting thing. We talked a few times last week about the NZSIS threat document that came out. And here's what the Director General of Security, Andrew Hampton, said in there. In terms of that category, talking about who's a threat, the most concerning was the white-based identity extremists, a group that was a growing concern to the NZSIS was individuals, many young, who were described as mixed, unclear, unstable motivations. They don't adhere strongly to any one particular ideological group. They often have quite self-styled motivations. They're often fixated with violence. Okay, where's the mention of the gangs? They've got firearms. They're criminals. There's over 30,000 of them.
No
mention.
It's all connected in the sense that, governments love anything that make people demand less freedom and more government, and gangs do the opposite. They make people demand less freedom.
What planet is Andrew Hampton on?
Yeah, and also, if you think who's going to resist the technocratic, neo-feudalist globalization effort, they are people of that description.
One of the things we're seeing, I think, in a number of countries, and including New Zealand, is this move towards two-tier policing, where a number of different sort of minority groups, the police are taking the attitude of cutting them slack. But whereas towards sort of the bulk of the population, the majority, are taking a tougher line. And so you're getting, if you post the wrong thing on social media and you're in that group, you're getting the police turning up to your door, checking that you're not posting the wrong thing. You're literal thought police if you're in that group, but they're turning a blind eye to, you know, violence and drugs and criminal activity and provocations from some of these other groups. So I think that we're seeing two-tier policing. We're also seeing two-tier intelligence gathering, two-tier threat assessments from the intelligence agencies as well, at least in what they're saying publicly. So.
One of the things I found really interesting is how they've come down really hard on the Comancheros. And, you know, that is a massive operation that they've obviously undertaken. Massive number of seizures, arrests, drug captures, everything is there. But it's one of the things that makes me wonder is nature abhors a vacuum. So surely if they've gone and taken all of these guys out of circulation, that void is only going to be filled by somebody else. So does this mean that they're going to then go and clamp down on whoever fills that void? And I found it interesting that they hit that gang. They are quite new and quite ostentatious, but things like the Mongrel Mob, for example, and Black Power, other than, as Marty said, one of them starting to show sort of a bit of abhorrent behaviour or whatever here and there, as an organisation, they tend to be left alone. And I do wonder, is there a reason for that?
Yeah, it's like the mongrel mob of Foodstuffs and the Black Power of Woolworths. It's kind of like our supermarket duopoly, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gang duopoly.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cooperation between the police and gangs. And again, I beat it to death, but government loves anything that makes people demand less freedom and more government. So all of these inexplicable things that you'd think, well, they could solve that. Some of them just suit them fine. Incompatible immigrants, fatherless children, prisons that don't reform, they fit that bill.
And you look at there was an opinion piece with Harry Tam in the Sunday Star Times on the weekend, and under his byline was lifetime mongrel mob member and co-director of H2R Research and Consulting.
What?
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is we know that Harry's kind of gone legit because his consulting, remember, was used during COVID as he popped across the border to go up to Northland to help increase jab rates with apparently some female help in case he got lonely.
Well, so, he had a side business writing, what are those reports they write for?
Oh, a cultural sensitivity reports.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been a concerted effort in the media to kind of legitimize Harry Tam as a respected commentator, kind of. And there's a lot of people in the community pushing back against that.
Hmm. And then there's the Black Power equivalent here as well. Was it Dennis O'Reilly?
Dennis O'Reilly, yeah.
Yeah, and he's the Black Power version thereof.
But you don't get up the tree in those gangs without
breaking a few branches on the way there.
A few benchmarks, a few KPIs, right?
Leadership capability, is that what you're saying, Paul?
Well, however you want to describe it.
Well, they're not shy to use PR. I've written a few letters that have gotten a few mongrel mob members' dogs out of a few pounds. I wasn't a member of the mob.
Right. Also, there are other things around this whole concept of, and the story that we're sort of leveraging off right now is Herald story, anti-gang legislation. But also there's talk of, discounts for guilty pleas, aggravating factors if you're attacking a sole dairy owner or shop person. I mean, if someone that I loved was dealt to and there were two people behind the counter, I wouldn't be thinking that someone could get a discount or it would be more aggravating if there was only one. There's all these sort of tweaky things to it, right? And pleading guilty, if you're guilty, you've done it anyway. You've got to be punished anyway.
Well, that's a cost-saving effort often, isn't it? If everyone pled not guilty in the States, I remember someone saying the justice system would collapse. It was particularly jarring seeing that story on Carlos Harris's sentencing for kidnapping that lady and torturing her for a month. I actually got an outraged text from an ex-detective friend of mine who said, where is the justice for the victim in the sentence of 8 years with a non-parole period of only 4 years? The maximum is 14 years. Pathetic is all I can say. And Shane Jones made that same point when I can't remember who was talking to him about how Māori were disproportionately affected by this. He made a very good point. What about all the Māori victims?
Yeah, I saw that.
Do you not care about them?
Well, that's the other side of it. I think you hit the nail on the head there, Marty, because the majority of victims in a lot of this crime that gangs perpetrate especially are Māori on Māori.
Mm.
So, they are also the greatest victims of all of this crime. They're the ones, they're the women who are suffering from abuse, they're the children that, I mean, let's face it, the number of children, the number of Māori children that have died alone in the last 5 years is just abhorrent, and most of those have died generally at the hands of a partner or another family member. For me, I'd much rather see that there's work done in that space than mucking around the edges and worrying about taking off gang insignia and saying to a recidivist offender, no, you can't even have that up on your wall. You can't have that mongrel mob flag on the wall of the inside of your own home. Really? I'd be worried about all the other things that would be going on the inside of that own home if there is violence or a threat to children, and you're worrying about whether or not they've got a bulldog stuck up on their wall. It's,
or doing a bit of woofing. There was that he's a criminologist that, and I haven't got his name at hand, but he made that comment on the murders in Auckland, said, oh, it's nothing to worry about. And then you go and look at his LinkedIn page and read some of his publications, and he is an absolute self-described Marxist.
Oh, is that your mate Kramer?
It is. Enforcement of the law is basically strengthening and enforcement of colonization and controlling brown youth. So there's a whole tale of just awful thinking that's worked its way through the justice system from Labor that's got to be yanked out.
It's like some kind of Stockholm syndrome.
Well, there's the fawning response as well among quite a few people where they side with the strongest party, and that's the gangs for a lot of people.
Yeah, so right. Just to what Marie was saying, I mean, we're told it's discriminatory if Maori being locked up and put in prison in larger numbers, which they are. But if you were to not do that, if you were to reduce the population or police them less strongly, that would result in more crime against the Maori victims. And so that would really have probably a worse and more discriminatory effect if you were to go soft on it.
That favourite Theodore Dalrymple quote of mine, it's a common misconception that if there were more justice in the world, there'd be fewer people in prison. There are plenty of scumbags who really deserve to be in prison and should be.
Well, just don't do criminal things. It's simple. It's not that hard, is it?
Well, it's hard for some people. Some people seem to lack the self-control or the good sense to be able to not do it.
Yeah, okay. I was speaking to a woman who worked in corrections who was saying that, you know, there are some people and you just need to lock them up till they're 45.
Yeah.
And that's kind of about the age, you know, they're too old to be jumping over fences and burgling houses.
The testosterone levels start to plummet by then. Violent inclination goes away. So
feed them soy.
Well, you know how you were saying things that are connected, right, with all of these stories. One of the connections with that, of course, is the builds into the fact that Nicola Willis now announced that these government contracts that they're going to start leveraging, before you had to have an 8% proportion of them go to Māori businesses, and they're now going to start proportioning these contracts out on the basis of data, you know, so being the best person for the contract is the one that gets the job, essentially. And when you have those, particularly in the area of health, who are saying, well, no, you know, you need these specific people in the areas of health that are able to target Māori and Pacifica areas, so therefore Māori business is the best to do that. And they don't drill down on the data. All they do is they look at the race. So therefore, if they're Māori or identify as a Māori business, therefore they must be qualified to deliver those services. Instead of drilling down and asking all of those questions that if Māori are disproportionately represented in health statistics for whatever reason, could it actually be because they're living in impoverished rural areas and poor housing, or they are in urban areas and overcrowding, they've got bad diets? Is there a dad in the home? Is there abuse in the home? What is the criminality and elements of people coming and going from the home? Do they have parents who are struggling, who are only solely relying on benefits and have issues with mental health, drug or addictions? There's so many questions that you could be asking, but what do they do? No, we just race. That's the only
idea. I don't think we can sort this out. The problem's too big, Marie. You think of the armies of people that would have to drill down to that level of detail and then be effective in.
Well, that's where social bonds are an interesting concept. If you have an organization that takes a population, say, we'll deliver these improvements in the numbers and get paid for the waypoints on the way to those improvements.
Mm. And also, William.
I was just going to say, I'm willing to entertain the idea that Maori health providers may have some sort of advantage in providing services to Maori communities. But in order to fund those providers, you don't need to explicitly target on the basis of race. I mean, if they're effective at doing that, they should be able to build a business case that shows that, and the person awarding the contract should be able to evaluate that and then award the contract on the basis that they're the most suitable person to be providing these health services into the community. So you don't need explicit targeting on the basis of race or ethnicity in order to allow a certain proportion of that kind of thing to happen.
When it comes to health, I think we've learned here at RCR that unless you change the diet of the nation, you're whistling Dixie. You're never going to change anything. In fact, it's a sickness system. And to educate people, it's like smoking. How long did that take? To educate people to that level is just a huge, massive undertaking. And people will, they might go along with it. They may not, just go past the drive through at Macca's. It's always full, So good luck with that.
Well, my view is that when we're looking for solutions from government that would be better coming from within the population of New Zealand, it squashes the will within people to make changes and try new things. Government fears a vacuum because the nature of politicians is to crave relevance and credit. But, we should maybe recognize the need for empty space. It's a bit like our children need to be bored to be creative.
Maybe it is possible. Look at RFK's come out and said a few things. Suddenly, a good chunk of Americans are thinking about what they're eating, processed food, things like that. Just takes someone to be balls enough to stand up and say, actually, this is what we've got to do. And like him, with the following like him, I don't know what the New Zealand equivalent is. Anyway.
Well, the relentless growth of government in terms of percentage of GDP to fill any space where it's not present, it has steadily eroded the agency and initiative of Kiwis, I think.
Yeah.
And also the amount of the lack of discretionary income and time that Kiwis have as we get crunched more and more by that growing government stops a lot of those initiatives.
Yeah, it's the iron law of bureaucracy. So there's bureaucracies always grow. They always find ways to grow. All the incentives for the managers within the bureaucracy are to expand the size and scope of their team and their budget.
And entropy.
I've worked inside government departments, and when the end of the year comes due, and when it's time for their budget, they've got any money unspent, then they just blow it all at the end of the year. Or they send everyone to training courses and stuff like that. Because if they don't do that, then the budget allocation to the manager will be reduced in the next year, and no manager wants that. They want to be in charge of more funds, not less. So all the incentives within these bureaucracies go towards growth. And the only way to really shrink bureaucracies that I've seen that's been successful is for when, more right-wing governments come in, they do it in one fell swoop. They chop whole departments down. One go. So that's the approach I think you need to take.
All right, conscious of time. J.D. Vance, assassination attempt of Trump shows need to check rhetoric. Boy, is he onto something there. And there may now have been a third attempt on him. Details are sketchy. Tucson rally. People have been complaining of headaches, burning sensations. We've heard of Havana syndrome before. Seems to be a real thing. We know about these kind of new weapons. The sonic cannons were fired at the protesters in Wellington, it seems. I think that's pretty clear. I don't know if any of you saw Piers Morgan with Candace Owens, Cenk Uygur, and the guy Prince. And Yuga's going off like a mad thing and just totally deranged. And this is what happens when you have that level of derangement. It's wild, right?
Yeah, well, I can't really speak to that because I haven't seen that clip. But, I mean, there is an interesting conversation to be had here around, the limits to free speech and media incitement to violence. When can speech incite violence when you're doing it? When you're raising the rhetorical tone through the media, which is what J.D. Vance is accusing the U.S. mainstream media of doing, leading to the assassination attempts on Donald Trump. And there's no doubt that media has the ability to, rile people up due to the way it discusses things. And so the question is, what do you do about it? Because you don't want to pass laws that prevent a legitimate discussions from happening. So there needs to be some sort of, some sort of system where different media outlets commit to holding each other accountable for their language.
Well, you can't lie. You shouldn't be lying. They lie.
They do lie. They do lie.
Barefaced.
Sometimes they do, but sometimes what are conceived of as lies are really differences of perspective or differences of different value judgments or differences of, philosophical or political perspective.
Well, when it comes to Trump, you always hear that thing, Charlotte, good people on both sides. Hammer it. And I know people who are deranged over that. I say to them, did you hear the rest of what he said right after that? Also, the bloodbath comment. He was talking about the auto industry. I watched the clip. If you stopped at a particular place, you could make a case, selective editing, in your news bulletin, your soundbite bulletin, that he was saying that there'd be a bloodbath like a civil war. They keep on bringing out January 6th. Everything I've seen about January 6th, it's not an insurrection if no one turns up without, they've got no guns.
Sounds like you're making a case for misinformation laws, Paul. We might have to ship
them. Well, no, I don't want those laws, but I don't like them frickin' lying.
Well, no one wants lies, but I mean, the way to hold it accountable is for other people to call it out and to have a contest of ideas, is what I would say. But anyway.
And the other thing, too, is you just need to see their ratings. I mean, the ratings for legacy media in the United States is tanking. Absolutely tanking, including
But it's not
Fox.
Stopping idiots going up and thinking they're going to save the world because anchor told them.
Yes, but the reality of it, Paul, is you're always going to have idiots and you're never going to be able to stop them.
Next level. Never happened last time or any time before that. 63 was the last time this happened.
Oh, no, I would say Ronald Reagan would have something to say to be
he
fair.
He took a bullet, but he didn't die. Okay, all right, you got that. Well, that was 30. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, as William was just saying, is that you have to be really careful because I agree with you. I mean, every now and then I'll have a little glimpse over to something in CNN or BBC World or whatever it may be to see what's being said. And it is literally like listening to fingernails down a chalkboard. But what I'm buoyed by and where the hope that I have is the hundreds and thousands and millions even in the US of eyeballs and ears who are just going, no, we're not tuning in anymore. We're going to look for news elsewhere. And you only need to see that with the growth of Joe Rogan, with the growth of Tucker Carlson out of nowhere onto X, the growth of Megyn Kelly, Candace Owens, all these other providers who are providing information for people and they're just quietly leaving. Are you going to get those nut jobs out there like this chap Routh, like this the young boy and the young shooter on the roof? Of course you're going to. And that's where the people that are there to protect Donald Trump need to be doing their jobs. And there's still loads of questions around the quality of Secret Service protection that he's been getting. So, I think you play, it's just very, very dangerous with the media. I think they're the people that they're going to be killing if they, fingers crossed that nothing happens with Donald Trump between now and the election, is their own careers and their own networks. And for me, that's a death that won't come soon enough. Just saying.
I agree.
Well, I mean, Mike Benz is interesting on this, and this brings me back to my original point about all these points that are connected. Mike Benz said that the US mainstream media is not in any shape or form, even from its outset, independent from the national security state. So, they really don't want Donald Trump. And so you've got to see whatever's happening and the way it's being reported in that context.
But what happens if he's taken out? What happens? You imagine what happens?
Well, one of the good things about, from the Trump's perspective anyway, about picking J.D. Vance is he's kind of got assassination insurance there. If they assassinate Trump now, they perhaps get someone in who they maybe like even less.
Well, I'm thinking, it could be a conflict, internal conflict in the United States, and it won't be pretty. And if there is, we will have a problem.
Yeah, they don't want to do that. They really don't want to do that. And Americans are too comfortable to have a civil war at this point. But Kamala Harris is...
Well, not even a civil war, but significant conflict.
Well, define significant conflict, because they certainly had that at the beginning of 2020 and they managed to mop that up fairly quickly.
My feeling is that that the temperature's so high that, I mean, I could sit here for hours going on about it, but the heat is so, it's so white hot that, and plenty of people are saying this, this could be a problem here where the two just go at each other, the two sides, they're so polarized, they're so divided, they hate each other.
Yeah, but they, but it's like, how do they go at each other though? I mean, will they go at each other
guns?
Physically?
Yeah, Republicans have got more testosterone, more guns, hotter women.
Okay, well, that solves it then. Can we join the left? Asking. You're women. It's the women. Okay, well, let's see what happens. But it's a worry. It's a worry. And the heat's on because Ukraine is in the mix as well, right? I mean, they're holding out the Democrats because that is about to fall. There's just so much at stake, I would say.
Well, if you look at the last assassination alleged plotter, you know, there are those weird ties to the Ukraine and BlackRock.
Yeah, how come they're both in the BlackRock commercial? How does that work? What are the odds of that?
Yeah, there's a photo of them being bused to a Kamala Harris show.
Show. All right. Anything more to say about that?
Well, I just hope they don't steal the election because that'll put things into a state of despair and, they'll be ready to crack down on any dissent that follows that.
Well, and I think also too, the legacy media over there are actually making 2016 2.0. They actually don't realise they're doing all the things that they did in 2016, which handed Donald Trump the presidency. And I don't think they realise with every single mention and everything that they're doing, the rhetoric that they're spouting, the bile that they're spitting left, right and centre is actually playing into the Trump camp. I mean, just look at those polls, the needles that got shifted after each of these attempts. There hasn't been a massive needle shift after the debate. There hasn't. People know, even the Democrats know that Kamala Harris is a vacuous vessel. I mean, at the end of the day, she's a day drunk who has fallen upwards and slept away to the top. They know it. Everybody knows it. So they're not, those who are diehard Democrats are going to vote for her because they'll never believe that they could vote for anybody else. But I do wonder whether or not you will have a situation in the United States like you did in the United Kingdom, where the most powerful voting bloc is the one that doesn't turn out. What happens then?
Postal voting. And postal voting, just going back to my to Mike Benz, postal voting and COVID were the most rigged discussions on the internet. Anything around postal voting, AI was jumping on and switching out as fast as possible.
Well, that tells you something, doesn't it? That tells you something.
Yeah, the potential for rigging the mail-in voting is just huge. And you can see the New York Times is already priming its audience to expect, strange things like it happened in, 2020 or 2024 with the vote where that Trump appeared to be ahead, but then everyone went to bed and they came back in the morning and...
That was Pennsylvania, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so every single priming vote. People to expect that sort of thing again. It just gives them time to bring, the trucks full of the ballots from the people that rounded up the communities and bring them in as they need to change the vote.
Yeah, how do you lose a 15-point lead? You all go to bed and have a 3-hour break and wake up in the morning.
Yeah. And those lines on the graph are like most improbable lines you could ever mathematically get. All right, should we look across the Tasman now? Problems, the coalition at last. The coalition slamming revised online misinformation bill. I think they still believe that there should be one, but they're slamming it. So what's going on there?
Yeah, well, there's two big threats to free speech going on in Australia. There's this mis- and disinformation bill, which would involve setting up an authority, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, I think it's called, and they would have the ability to put huge fines on social media companies up to 5% of their profit levels.
Global profit.
Yeah, for spreading mis and disinformation, which would basically, it's such a big threat that if that would turn the social media companies themselves into the censors, they would censor their own platforms in order to not incur those fines. And the other one is a sort of hate speech bill. So they've redone their hate speech bill. And so that increases the fines significantly and introduces a large number of protected minority groups that, you know, that mean that if you were to say anything that was could be considered hateful by those minority groups, you could be fined, you could go to jail potentially. So a couple of big threats to free speech there.
It's also got anything that causes imminent harm to the economy or the stock market.
Yeah, we talked about that on Legal Hub.
Amazing.
Or criticizes a CBDC, maybe.
So this is just taking legitimate conversations, legitimate aspects of political debate, and turning it into hate speech and making it so you can't discuss it. It's about protecting certain groups in society, including apparently banks and financial providers, and making sure people can't criticize them. Or, you know, it's because, you know, words do have power, and they have power to affect things. That's why, you know, the Reserve Bank governor can come out and engage in things called open mouth operations to try and change what's happening in the interest market, interest rate market, and things like that. So words have power, but we need to be able to discuss things in order to have proper intellectual debate, proper democracy, proper election, proper voting.
So in other words, criticism is now going to be criminalised.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. While I was snuffling around this topic, I came across that quote from JFK where he said, "We are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values. For a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people." And that's, I guess, Australia.
Yeah.
Yep.
But this mirrors things that are happening right across the whole Western world, I guess, or pretty much all of it. There's a movement afoot to, in the name of safety, take away people's rights, take away their freedoms, especially their freedom to speak. And I think a big part of it is, you know, the ability to disseminate your opinion, your point of view, used to be, you know, constrained to relatively small numbers of people, but now it's sort of become democratized with the internet and social media. So relatively unknown people who can't be vetted or controlled by the authorities now have the ability to get their information out there and inform or large numbers of people. So people who are in power and want to control the national conversation don't necessarily like that.
And you're labeled hate. That use of the word, people know what it means, but it's been recalibrated to mean I don't like someone or I'm criticizing someone or what they do. That now is hate. So that means everything is off the table almost, doesn't it?
Yeah, and just from a practical perspective, some of these things that can be considered hateful, they're subjective, and something that's hateful for one group can be a normal and even positive thing for another group. So if you take the recent protests we've had in New Zealand here around the pro-Palestine protests and the pro-Israel people, from the river to the sea is, you know, it's hateful for one group, but it's a pro-freedom chant for the other. And vice versa. So there's a number of different areas like that mean, you know, there's just a conflict in how different groups and different communities view what is hateful versus what is good and normal and loving and a normal thing that they would say.
Well, I just wonder whether the fact that my phone's normally on 2% means it's going to blow up with less force in my pocket one day.
Oh, how about that?
Oh, yeah. Because I've been in a little bit of a bubble the last few days. How on earth how did they manage to do that?
They put an order through a Taiwanese company who licensed the manufacturing to a front company for Mossad Israel, or one of the Israeli operations in Hungary, I think it's been reported.
Yeah.
And then the electronic items were manufactured or modified. Not sure if they were modified after manufacture or manufactured there with the devices in them. So that order was intercepted. The Taiwanese company said they had no idea, okay? and then shipped to the Hezbollah people who made the order, and we know the rest.
About an ounce of explosives in each, and apparently there's been a follow-up with some walkie-talkies as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, if you're, you know, I've heard people say it's genius, that'll teach them. But what if you're sitting in a car next to a little kid?
Well, there was that, and I mean, it does bring a whole new meaning to sort of danger of 5G, doesn't it? Ooh. You know, imagine, it's the whole thing.
I don't know if walkie-talkies qualify there, so that's an interesting one, because they're not usually connected to a, you know, cell phone network. They're usually transmitted old-style radio, I could be wrong. Yeah.
If you're going to open them up and put explosives in them, I guess you can put something in them that will allow you to do that.
Part of the genius of this, I think, is that it's targeting their communications, right? And for any group to be effective, they need a way of, you know, communicating between the members. And they didn't want to, the group's leaders told them not to use cell phones because they were worried about Israel being able to track the cell phones and then send drones to do targeted drone strikes on the cell phones that were, you know, talking about the things they didn't like. But now they've gone after the pages as well. So that, you know, the Hezbollah people are going to be sitting there wondering, well, how are we going to talk to each other? How are we going to organise our communications now?
Oh, they're going to be weaponising strings soon and tin cans. What you mark my, you know, that's what they're going to do.
Well, I saw the meme of the Hezbollah communications official with their carrier pigeons on the internet. So,
yeah, I mean, that's all very funny, but you know, it doesn't get anyone anywhere, does it?
Oh, look, I mean,
are they any less angry? Are they any less wanting to, you know, kill the first Israeli they see because the, you know?
This is a conflict. How do you solve a conflict that's more than 2,000 years old?
Well, Between two very disagreeable groups of people who both think they're destined to rule over everyone else. It is a
Clayton's choice, really.
Well, it just perpetuates it unless someone drops a huge weapon on someone and ends it all for good, which is probably where it's heading.
Yeah, it's not going to be that sort of show. I don't think we've got the bulldozers to go into Gaza with that one. But it's horrible. And I hear what you're saying about the indiscriminate nature of, you know, what about the kids that are inevitably going to be sitting next to one of these things going off? Yeah, and I mean, there's all sorts of things around that, like the propensity of the Israeli Defense Forces to shoot the genitals off small kids who are throwing, you know, there's a lot of documentation of that. It's not something, yeah.
I mean, it's really smart and dastardly. I get all that. You know, it's a genius sort of James Bond thing. I understand that. But, you know, where does it get anyone?
Well, they've been trying to, that is the question of the ages, isn't it?
My interest is around the people who are trying to import it here and take a side and make it analogous to a side here. That's what really bothers me. That's what I find more locally distasteful anyway, wearing your Palestinian shawls. And.
But they've got the right.
As globalization has progressed, it's become more and more difficult for people to remain neutral in a lot of these faraway global conflicts. It seems to, you know, natural alliances have sort of formed up in the domestic sort of political debates as well. So one side tends to side with the Palestinians, one side with the Israelis. There's not always a lot of sense behind it, but often, you know, with the herd mentality that exists and the desire people have not, you know, to go along with the people who whose group they're in. It's getting harder and harder for people to remain neutral on these sorts of things.
Well, that's all part of, I mean, because I look at culture, William, I look at the tribalism around it, and this is all part of that tribal. And you're dead right. People will, you know, one side will naturally side with one conflict or one group and another side will side with the other. And it's a wave of this overt virtue signalling, which I just find really distasteful. I mean, I'd go back to, I'd much rather all of these people, that, you know, these there's people that are out on street corners on a weekend with their Palestinian flags or their Israeli flags when they're trying to get toot support, what have you. You know, take all of those efforts into your local community and actually start looking, working at a food bank, seeing what's going on in your local community, what's happening with those kids that don't have shoes that they need to go to school with, haven't got the school books that they need, are in actually a home that could be violent or sad. Put your efforts there.
Yeah, you're right on.
Put your efforts there and actually start making a difference at home in our own backyard, because it's not exactly, you know, moonbeams and rainbows here all the time either. And I have to admit, that's for me. I look at that and think, you know, you've got the time to do that. What are you doing at home? So that's, you know, I get a bit sparky with that sort of stuff.
I agree with you. I think you're right on that. Absolutely.
It's a lot harder to do that than it is to drape a flag on yourself.
I get that too, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We've burned through a lot of time, folks. It's gone quick. Anything else that anyone wants to say before we hit the emergency stop? And everybody flies forward.
Well, I have to say, Paul, you've had an absolute cracking week this week. Gosh, lots of stuff. And I caught you with Katie yesterday and talking about the NZDSOS conference, and she's heading up to Japan as well. And she said she's a hugger. So from me to you to Katie, give Katie a big hug from me. That's what I'd like to say.
I will.
Thank you. And have a good time.
All right. Thank you. Marty.
Yeah, no, much the same. I'm hopefully heading to NZDSOS the week after next. So that'll be great. And yeah, there's been some great interviews yesterday morning, just before Katie, who was the lady you spoke to, who was talking about a lot of that globalist stuff. And I couldn't find her on the replays, but and that's the danger of listening to things, isn't it? You hear things, but you can't necessarily index them in your mind. But there's been some great
stuff. I'd have to go back into the schedule, Marty, because my short-term RAM memory dumps stuff pretty quick. So you know how it is? Yeah, but thank you for that. And William, when's the next spin cycle? What's going to be in it?
It is on Tuesdays. Tuesdays at about 1, is it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll be pottering around at home trying to put that together.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on the panel, William, and thanks for the work you do for us. It's great.
No, it was a real pleasure to be on here and to talk to you guys. Interesting issues.
Yeah. And we'll do it all again in a week. See you later, everybody.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.